Last time we ended up talking about mitosis and meiosis, and today what we want to talk a little bit about is gametogenesis, how gametes are formed. We're going to start out talking about spermatogenesis and then talk about oogenesis a little bit later on. In spermatogenesis, in human males, it occurs, of course, in the testes. Okay, and when we talk about spermatogenesis, this is a process that once a male reaches sexual maturity, it occurs on a constant basis. It basically doesn't stop until the male dies, right? Unless some sort of injury occurs to the testes. You might have heard of people, males that father children, you know, in their 80s and 90s. That is realistic, okay, for males to do that. And so before we talk about spermatogenesis, what I want to talk about are some specialized cells at the very first part of spermatogenesis called spermatogonium. Spermatogonium are found in the external parts of the testes. So if we were to look at a cross-section through a testes, what we would find is that the spermatogonium are found around the outside of the seminiferous tubules. Okay, and these spermatogonium are cells that don't themselves go through meiosis, but the results of their mitosis, one of the cells is going to go through meiosis and the other one is going to go through mitosis. Okay. So what happens is we start out with this two-man spermatogonium cell. The spermatogonium is going to go through mitosis, right? So it's going to produce two brand new two-man cells. Now here's where things are a little bit different than normal mitosis. What's going to happen is one of these new cells is going to become the new spermatogonium. The other two-man cell is going to become what we call the primary spermatocyte. Okay. And this is the cell that's going to go through meiosis now. Right? So what's going to happen to this new spermatogonium? Well, it's going to go through mitosis again to produce two new two-man cells. One of those new two-man cells is going to become the new spermatogonium. And the other is going to become a primary spermatocyte. Okay, so by using this process, there is always going to be a spermatogonium, right? And that spermatogonium is always going to produce a new spermatogonium. Any questions about that? So because of that, spermatogenesis can occur again once the male reaches sexual maturity, from then until the end of their life. Okay. Any questions about that? Yeah?
Does sperm die when it hits the air?
Not necessarily, but the answer is in a very short amount of time they will die. Okay? So, actually, do sperm die when they hit the air? The answer is no. If you think about it, sperm donors, okay. The sperm's actually hitting the air at that time. It's just you don't let it dry out, essentially. Okay. So this primary spermatocyte is the cell that's going to go through meiosis, right? So at this point, this primary spermatocyte goes through the linear process of meiosis. So it goes through the interphase, where the cell is going to double from 2N to 4N, and then it's going to go through meiosis 1, which includes prophase 1, metaphase 1, anaphase 1, telophase 1, cytokinesis, okay? And two new 2N cells are going to be produced. These 2N cells are what we call secondary spermatocytes. Now these 2N cells are going to go through the second meiotic division, prophase 2, metaphase 2, anaphase 2, telophase 2, and produce four cells that are 1N. And these cells are what we call spermatids. Any questions about that? So really, we've kind of outlined just simple meiosis. We've just added some new terminology to apply to the sperm instead of just generalized meiosis, right? Okay. So essentially, what happens to this primary spermatocyte is it goes through interphase where synthesis occurs. So it goes to a 4N cell. We go through the first meiotic division, get two new 2N cells. Go through the second meiotic division, get four 1N cells called spermatids. Any questions about that? So pretty straightforward meiosis once we get past the spermatogonium up here at the top. Any questions? Now, the spermatid is a viable cell. In other words, if you were to take a spermatid at this point and you were to fuse it with an ovum, it would produce a 2N individual or an offspring. Okay. The problem here is that in humans, the place where fertilization occurs is where? Anybody know in a female? It's amazing. You guys are college kids. Yeah, occurs in the fallopian tubes. And if you think about where sperm deposition occurs in the vagina, from there to the fallopian tubes, it's actually quite a distance, right? You have to go through the cervix, up through the uterus, and up into the fallopian tubes for fertilization to occur. And so these spermatids, at this point, do not have any modification to them. And so if males were to deposit just these spermatids into the vagina, no fertilization event would ever occur. And so what has to happen is kind of an extra step in gametogenesis in males. They have to modify these spermatids into what we call spermatozoa, or what most of you call sperm. Okay? And basically, when we talk about a spermatozoa, there are a number of modifications that have to occur to the spermatid. The first modification is that they need to produce kind of this little cap-like structure called the acrosome. And what the acrosome looks like underneath the microscope is a little stocking cap or a beanie over the head of the sperm. Okay? We're going to talk about what the function of the acrosome is here in a minute. Then, in addition, a midpiece and a tail needs to be added to this spermatid. The midpiece is simply a bunch of energy. It's a kind of a fuel cell, I guess you could say. The tail is a flagellum. We talked about what flagellum are used for, right? Flagellum are used to move cells from one place to another. But in order to be or to move, those flagellum need energy. Okay? And that energy is found in the midpiece. The midpiece is just simply filled with mitochondria. Okay? So there's tons and tons of mitochondria in that midpiece. And again, it's kind of like a fuel cell. There's a limited amount of fuel in the midpiece. Okay? So, again, using our analogy of a spaceship, if you use a fuel cell to get the spaceship into orbit, say, for example, space shuttle, okay? Once that fuel is used, it's all gone. You can't refuel in space. The same thing is true with the sperm cell. Once all of the energy in the midpiece is used up, what happens to the spermatozoa? Basically quits moving. And if it quits moving, it's going to what? Basically crash and burn, kind of like a spaceship. Okay? So that energy is used to cause the flagellum to beat so that the spermatozoa can get up through the cervix, through the uterus, and up into the fallopian tube where fertilization can occur. Okay? Any questions about that? Now, these spermatozoa are actually very, very small. Right? In a teaspoon, a teaspoon will hold about a million spermatozoa. Okay? So these are the smallest cells in the human body. And if you think about it, in relationship to their size, how far they have to move, if you were to expand the spermatozoa up to human body size, like a 6-foot man, you know, and increase the size of the distance of the uterus and the oviduct or the fallopian tubes and everything up to, you know, kind of appropriate size. They have to actually move a long, long distance. It would be like a 6 foot tall man would have to walk almost the whole way around the world to move as far in relationship to their body size as sperm does in relationship to their body size for fertilization to occur. Okay. Any questions about that? And every time there's an ejaculate released in the human female, there are millions of sperm that are released. And hopefully one of them is going to be able to fertilize the ovum. Or in maybe some of your cases, hopefully it doesn't fertilize the ovum. Right? But that's kind of the whole goal here of sexual reproduction, right? Okay, is for one of those sperm to fertilize the ovum. Any questions about that? Just kind of an interesting side fact for you guys. If an ovum is being released and humans have intercourse, what are the chances that fertilization is going to occur? Some of you may think it's 100%, because it's for you it's 100%, but it's not. Okay, it's actually only about 60%. Okay, which is not extremely high. Right. Any questions about that? Now, once the spermatozoa comes in close proximity to that ovum, well, then the acrosome, that's where the acrosome comes into play. If we were to look at a human ovum, around that ovum there is a kind of a fluidy layer called the zona pellucida. And this fluid type layer called the zona pellucida makes it so that sperm cannot get in and fertilize the egg. And so what happens is the spermatozoa has the acrosome, that kind of the, like the little stocking cap on the end of the sperm. And what the acrosome is filled with is it's filled with enzymes. Right? So when that spermatozoa comes in contact with the zona pellucida, this acrosome breaks. And these enzymes allow the spermatozoa to kind of eat through the zona pellucida and fertilize the ovum. Right? So without that acrosome, that fertilization event is not going to occur. Any questions about that? In addition, what happens is once this acrosome breaks, the enzymes in this acrosome actually make this whole entire zona pellucida a hardened structure. Okay, it becomes hardened. Now, why does that occur?
So that you don't get more than one.
Yeah, so that only one fertilization event can occur. What you don't want happening is you don't want another sperm coming and fertilizing that ovum if this one's already fertilized it, right? Because then you would have a three in an individual, which wouldn't be good. Does that make sense to everybody? So what happens is as soon as that acrosome breaks and starts eating through the zona pellucida, removing through the zona pellucida, then the rest of the zona pellucida becomes a hardened structure so that no more fertilization can occur. Any questions about that? Yeah.
How are twins made then?
There's two ways in which twins are made. One is paternal twins are when you have two ovums that are being released at one time and both of them become fertilized. Identical twins actually is a result of just one fertilization event. After fertilization occurs, we know that the cell is going to go through mitosis, and we're going to go from a 2N cell to 2 2N cells, and then those 2 2N cells are going to go through mitosis and make 4 2N cells, and so forth and so on. At some point, usually about the 64 cell stage, what can sometimes happen is that cell mass may break in two. Okay, so instead of having one 64 cell mass, you have two 32 cell masses, or maybe it's not exact, but those cell masses break apart, and if both of those cell masses implant in the into the uterine wall, then you have identical twins. Any questions about spermatogenesis? All right, now let's talk a little bit about oogenesis. Oogenesis is a little bit more complicated, in oogenesis, what is going to be produced is the largest cell in the human body, fact, you can almost see an ovum with the naked eye. They're that large. Versus the sperm, which are the smallest cells in the human body. Okay. In addition, a very limited number of ovum are going to be produced by the female. Okay. And a female cannot produce ovum her entire life cycle. Right. In fact, when you ladies were born, you actually had a higher reproductive potential than you do today. Did you know that? Okay. You probably lost about half of your reproductive potential by your age. So what happens in oogenesis is this. Before the female child is born, the cells called oogonia, notice the similar terminology to the spermatogenesis, these cells called oogonia that are found in the ovary are going to go through mitosis. So if you had an original oogonia that's 2N, this cell is going to go through mitosis. We're going to get 2 2N cells. Each of those cells are going to go through mitosis. We're going to get 2 new 2N cells for each of the cells. And so on and so forth. Okay? And this process again occurs before birth. At about the time of birth, what's going to happen is all of these oogonia, all of these cells are oogonia, every one of these cells are going to start the process of meiosis. Right? They're going to go through interphase, including synthesis, so they're all going to become essentially 4N cells. Okay? And they're going to start the process of meiosis 1. And in fact, each of these cells are going to be arrested or stopped in prophase 1 of meiosis. Okay. They call it arresting, and some of you can relate. If you get arrested, you get stopped, right? Okay. And so it's stopped or arrested in prophase 1 of meiosis. So when a female child is born, she has her maximum reproductive potential. Okay. If we were to cut one of you ladies open and cut your ovaries open and look at the these are what we call primary oocytes now. I should have mentioned this. If we were to look at your primary oocytes underneath a microscope, what would we see? If the cell's in prophase 1, what's happened? We would actually see a cell with a bunch of chromosomes, right? Because in prophase 1, chromosomes up here. Would we see a nucleus? A nuclear membrane in those cells? We wouldn't. Okay. So basically within your ovaries, ladies, there are thousands of these cells in prophase 1 of meiosis. Does that make sense? Now, I mentioned that you've already lost about half of your reproductive potential. These primary oocytes can be injured or killed because of high fevers, physical injury that can occur, a lot of different things. Okay. Any questions about that? Yeah.
So is this on an ovary like an infection or like a bacteria or something?
No. No, it's actually a cyst. Cysts are formed, as far as I understand them, when basically every time one of these primary oocytes is going to be released, which we're going to talk about here in a minute, basically the ovary kind of cysts up and it ruptures and releases one of them. So what a cyst is when the ovaries don't really release the ovum like they should. So you can get, and when that happens, it generally in a female, if it happens once or twice, it generally tends to happen a lot of times. So females can have what they call polycystic ovaries, which means lots of cysts. I've actually seen pictures where they've gone in and treated those polycystic ovaries. And basically they go in and they cauterize or burn all of those cysts. Say, you know, hundreds or thousands of them. Any questions up to this point? So at this point, we have a primary oocyte. So it's a 4N cell. All right. Now here's where things get a little bit different. The cells go through meiosis one. So we're already in prophase one, right? The cell goes through metaphase one, anaphase one, telophase one, and then cytokinesis, and we end up with two end cells. Now I should mention that this occurs very rarely, this process of letting one of these arrested cells go through the rest of the process of meiosis. Basically, on average, it occurs about once every 28 days, and that's kind of the cycle in human females. But as most of you ladies know, 28 days is not necessarily normal. Okay? It's just kind of an average. Some females will release ovums much more commonly than every 28 days. Some females don't release them only every 32 days. And, you know, it's quite variable. Right? Any questions? So about once every 28 days, one of these ova are typically released. Now, if we're talking about the twins, the paternal twins, that we just talked about, instead of just releasing one ovum, they're going to release more than one ovum every 28 days, or at least when that fertilization event is going to occur. And that can happen as well. So in meiosis one, the cell is already in prophase one. We go through metaphase one, anaphase one, telophase one, and cytokinesis, and we end up with two end cells. Now here's where things are really different. Genetically, 2N genetic material is in each of these 2 new cells. However, the cytoplasm from these cells do not divide equally. Most of the cytoplasm goes with one cell that we call the secondary oocyte. Okay. Very little cytoplasm goes with this other cell that we call a polar body. So the secondary oocyte has most of the cytoplasm. The polar body has very little cytoplasm. Now, what's the significance of having cytoplasm? Well, if you have cytoplasm, you can produce what? Organelles, you can have cytoskeletal elements, all sorts of stuff. If you don't have any cytoplasm, the cell is eventually going to die. And that's essentially what happens to this polar body, is it actually is going to die in the female. This is the only viable cell as far as reproduction is concerned. Now, basically this cell, the secondary oocyte, is going to go through meiosis 2. So we have prophase 2, metaphase 2, anaphase 2, telophase 2, cytokinesis. In this cellular division, we produce 2 1N cells. Now here's where things are a little bit different again. The genetic material splits equally here, so we end up with 2 1N cells. However, one of the cells is actually going to be much larger than the other because the cytoplasm is going to divide unequally again. This cell, this 1N cell, is also what we call a polar body, so we don't change the terminology. And this 1N cell with all of the cytoplasm, or the majority of the cytoplasm, is what we call an ovum. Okay, or an egg. So we end up with one egg out of this process of meiosis. So it's a little bit different than what we talked about with normal meiosis. In normal meiosis, we end up with 4 1N cells. Well, that's true in females, in human females as well, but only one of those 1N cells is actually a good cell as far as reproduction is going to be concerned. This 2N cell right here, this 2N polar body, could actually go through the second meiotic division and produce 2 1N cells. However, that typically doesn't happen. Why? Yeah, there's no cytoplasm, there's no energy or anything else, and so essentially this cell just dies and the female body reabsorbs it. This cell right here, the second polar body that's produced, is essentially going to die as well. And the female body is just going to reabsorb some of the cell components from that polar body as well. And so only one ovum is produced, and this cell is very, very large. All right. Any questions? So why in female gametogenesis, or in oogenesis, is there only one 1N cell produced? Why does this cell need to have so much cytoplasm associated with it?
It's
going to
live a long time.
What's that?
It's
going
to last a long time.
Okay, it's got to live for a while without any other inputs. And that's essentially the answer. Okay, if you think about it, fertilization occurs in the fallopian tubes. What do males bring to the fertilization event? What does the sperm bring to it? Just one end genetic material, nothing else. They don't really have any mitochondria that they contribute. They don't really contribute anything but the genetic information. And so what has to happen is that zygote, a zygote is a 2N individual that's a result of fertilization. So that zygote has to survive from where it's fertilized in the fallopian tubes until it gets down the fallopian tubes and implants in the uterine wall of the human female. And then nutrients, after a while, can start to move from the mother to the zygote, right? Through the uterine wall, through something that we call a placenta. Okay? But it has to survive for a few days at least without any nutrients from any other source. Does that make sense, everybody? Same thing is true with the chicken. Only the chicken, the egg has to have enough nutrients to feed the zygote until it's born, which is even more. Any questions about that? Now, if you think about it, ladies, the oldest types of cells in your body are what? These primary oocytes, right? They are the oldest cell in your body right now. So what happens when these cells get really old? Yeah, they're going to start to deteriorate, okay? And they're going to start to kind of just break apart and be non-functional, okay? And so what happens is when ladies get older than you guys, you ladies in here, when they get into their 50s and 60s, ladies start to go through a process that we call what?
Menopause,
right? And why do ladies go through menopause? Yeah, essentially they've run out of ovums. They've run out of primary oocytes. Does that make sense? Okay. They've run out of primary oocytes, and so they don't have any more primary oocytes to give up. And if any of you have ever talked, if your moms are going through menopause or your grandma and you've talked to them about it, ladies, you'll find out that they have the symptoms of menopause. They might have them for 2 or 3 months, and then the symptoms will be released for a month or so, and then they'll have them again. You ever heard of that happening? Why does that happen? Well, maybe for 2 or 3 months the body can't produce any ovums, and then all of a sudden it finds an extra one that's hidden someplace, and goes through the process of meiosis again, and that releases the symptoms of menopause. Okay. Also, as you ladies get older, the chances of your children having birth defects because your primary oocytes are old go much higher. Does that make sense? So what happens is as these primary oocytes get older, if they start to go through the process of meiosis as you get older, cellular division may not occur exactly as we would expect it to occur. Right? And so what can happen is something that we call non-disjunction events can occur. We'll talk about non-disjunction in a couple of days, but basically it's when cellular division does not occur exactly the way that we would expect it to occur. And so what can happen is you can end up with something like 2 number 21 chromosomes and 1 of every other type of chromosome in the ovum. If that ovum is fertilized by a sperm, we end up with a disorder that we call trisomy 21. Anybody know what that's? Common name for that is? Down syndrome. Okay? So you end up with a child with Down syndrome. Does that make sense? It's kind of interesting. I have a professionally made graph a little bit later on in our presentation. I'll show it to you in a couple of days when we talk about non-disjunction. But it's something similar to this. So if this were age here, okay, and this were the instance of something like Down syndrome. This were 20 30, 40, and 50, okay? Your incidence of having a Down syndrome child looks something about like this. Once a female gets to be a little bit over 35, your chances of having a Down syndrome child go sky high. Can't remember the exact numbers, but right now, for you ladies, the chances that you're going to have a Down syndrome child are like 1 in 2,000 or something like that. It's really low. When you get to be age 40, it's like 1 in 20. Okay. So really quite high. Any questions? If you have a child at age 50, I believe it's something like 1 in 2 children born at age, if the mother's at age 50, will have Down syndrome. Any questions? Okay, so there's a big difference between spermatogenesis and oogenesis. In spermatogenesis, lots of cells are produced. Those cells are the smallest cell of any cell in the human body, and it occurs indefinitely. In oogenesis in females, a very small amount of cells are produced, and there's a limit to how long that can occur in a lifetime. And those cells are actually the largest cells in the human body. It's kind of interesting. Any questions about gametogenesis? So this is kind of showing the relative sizes of a sperm and an egg. You can see one's really small and one's very large. Any questions about gametogenesis? Okay. The next topic then that we want to start talking about is we want to talk about genetics. Okay. Genetics is the study of the patterns of inheritance from one generation to the next. So how are characteristics inherited from one generation to the next? That's basically the study of genetics. The study of genetics was not well understood until the 1800s. When a fellow named Gregor Mendel come around, he was a monk over in Europe, and basically he started to look at how the patterns of inheritance occurred in pea plants. Okay, and the study of how genetics occurs in kind of just looking at different characteristics from one generation to the next is sometimes what we call classical genetics. We can also look at the study of genetics on a cellular basis and look at DNA itself. And so the study of DNA and how patterns of inheritance occur in DNA are sometimes what we call cellular genetics. We're going to first of all talk about classical genetics, and then we're going to go in and talk about cellular genetics a little bit later on in the semester. But before we can talk about genetics, we need to define a couple of terms. The first term that we want to talk about are alleles. Alleles are genes that govern a trait that come in alternative forms. Okay? So genes that govern traits can come in alternative forms. Let's use Gregor Mendel's pea plants just kind of as an example here. What happens is, with most organisms, as we mentioned, most organisms are 2N. And that means that when we have a chromosome, a chromosome that crosses, that's your pair of chromosomes. Okay? So they have traits that are associated with these chromosomes, or parts of the DNA. These alleles can come in alternative forms. And so there may be a part of the chromosome that codes for flower color in peas. For example, we may have a flower color that is red, and it can also come in a different type of flower color. Peas can have flower color of white, and we're going to represent that by a little r for right now. Okay. So these alleles are traits that can come in alternative forms. All right. So for example, in humans, an allele that we could talk about is something that causes short or long fingers. Short fingers are what we call a dominant trait. We're going to introduce the term dominant here in a minute. And long fingers are what we call a recessive trait. You can either have short or long fingers. Okay. So when we talk about these alleles, we can introduce some other terms. One is what we call homozygous individuals, and one is what we call heterozygous individuals. A homozygous individual is an individual with two of the same alleles. A heterozygous individual is with two different alleles for a trait on the chromosome. Okay. So for example, what I've put up here, big R, little r, that is what we would consider to be a heterozygous individual. It has a big R and a little r. Okay. Another way of looking at this, if we were to just use alleles A, B, and I'm going to use D, okay. If we had big A on one chromosome, little a on another chromosome, that would be considered heterozygous. Okay, it comes in an alternate form. If we had an allele B, okay, and we had two big B alleles, then that is what we would call homozygous, a homozygous individual. They have the same alleles on both chromosomes. If we had another characteristic D, and both of them were represented by small d's, that would still be a homozygous individual. Okay, because they're both the same allele. All right. Now, also with alleles or traits, we can have dominant traits or recessive traits. Dominant traits are traits that express themselves, but they can mask the presence of other alleles. Up here on the board it says, but mask. It can mask the presence of other alleles. Recessive alleles are alleles that can be masked. Okay. Now generally when we're working with genetics, we use large letters for dominant alleles, small or lowercase letters for recessive alleles. Right? So for example, in this chromosome that we just built here, actually let's look over here. In this particular chromosome with flower color, we have a dominant allele that represents the red flower. The red is the dominant color in peas. And if we have a dominant red allele and a recessive allele, that would mean it would be a white flower, then what color would the flower be?
Red.
Okay, it would be red. All right. Okay. In this case over here, we have a heterozygous individual. Okay, we have a dominant A and a recessive A. This would represent what? Two dominant alleles, okay? And so we could actually use some terminology together here and say this is a homozygous dominant individual, okay? Because there are two dominant alleles. This would be what we would call what? A homozygous recessive individual, okay? Does that make sense? Because there's two recessive alleles. So going back to flower color, if we had an individual that was homozygous dominant, what color would that flower be? Okay, it would be red. If we had an individual that was heterozygous for flower color, what color would the flower be? Okay, it would be red. And the reason why is because this dominant allele can mask that recessive allele or make it so that the recessive allele can't be expressed. Okay. If we had a homozygous recessive individual for flower color, we would end up with what we would call a white flower. Okay. Now the reason why these recessive alleles can express themselves or show up, that's what express means, is to show up. The reason why they can express themselves is what? There's nothing that's going to cover them up. There's no dominant alleles. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So some more terminology now. The last couple of terms that we're going to talk about here are genotype and phenotype. Genotypes are alleles that are present, such as homozygous recessive, heterozygous, and homozygous dominant. The phenotype, on the other hand, is the character that is being expressed, such as red or white. By the way, before we move into that, these heterozygous individuals, would you call them heterozygous dominant or heterozygous recessive? This one we call homozygous dominant, right? Mm-hmm. This one's homozygous recessive. Actually, neither one of those terms is correct. It's just heterozygous. Heterozygous by its very nature means that they're what? They're different. Okay. Doesn't always mean that one's dominant, one's recessive, but it means that they're different. Okay. So we don't have to worry about it. Okay, so genotype. If we were to look at this genotype here, the genotype would be homozygous dominant. Okay, the phenotype would be what? Red. Okay. In this second one here, the genotype would be what? Heterozygous. Okay. And the phenotype would be red. Or another way of expressing this genotype, we could actually say big R, little r, okay, dominant and recessive. In this one here, what's the genotype? Homozygous recessive, okay, so two little r's. And the phenotype is
white.
Okay. So think of it this way. The genotype are the genes or the alleles that are there. The phenotype is what characteristic is being expressed. Okay. So for example, we could talk about phenotype for hair color. Okay. Some of you have a phenotype that makes your hair black, right? Some of you have a phenotype of brunette. Some of you have a phenotype of blonde. Does that make sense? So phenotype is what is being expressed. The genotype is something else, okay? It's the actual genes that are present. Another example of what we would call a monohybrid characteristic, or they only have one allele or one dominant and recessive allele, would be something like freckles in humans, okay? If you have freckles, that is a dominant characteristic, okay? But the phenotype would be either freckled or non-freckled, right? The genotype could be a lot of different things. It could be either homozygous dominant, heterozygous, or homozygous recessive. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, so phenotype is what is being expressed. The genotype are the alleles that are present. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, let's go ahead and stop there for today. On Wednesday, we are going to talk about monohybrid and dihybrid crosses. Okay, we're going to actually show you how to figure out how to predict what's going to happen when individuals of two different genotypes cross, okay, or mate.